foundational to applying what John was communicating. When you think of faith, hope, and love, the greatest of these is love. And obviously, there's an order to things, and I don't know how they all relate. And each one of those are very, very deep subjects, yet they're really important. All three of them are really, really important. There's lots of quotes and story about the idea of hope and how necessary it is to our psyche, which is the Greek word for soul. It's that somehow if we don't have hope, we just don't function. We can't function. And I don't think we can actually function at all without faith. And certainly love is a huge piece of it, how love is expressed in our health and life and vitality and joy. All three of those things are really, really important, but hope is unique because it's a qualifier for at least one of the others. And the theme that I pick up from Psalm 61 through 63 is this idea of waiting. And that part of hope doesn't fit well with our flesh as human beings, period. But certainly in our culture, we don't wait for anything. We don't wait for anything. Everything has this huge, amazing speed and pace and expectation. One of the things we did, my dad was a lover of golf, and that was one of the things I shared with him. And so we've been, this 17 years since the last time we went out to the area in Monterey. That was the surprise trip when I took her, and we toured the coast of California for a few days on our 20th anniversary. And we went back and relived some of those things. But Pebble Beach is on that, which is a very famous golf course. Incredibly expensive to play because of how you have to play it. It's gorgeous. I had it on Tiger Woods Golf, and I would play it, and I would know it. And just lots of shared memories of that, of Pebble Beach. And one of the things at the visitor center was they had these benches sitting out, and you kind of look over the golf course. You can't really see the golf course a lot from there, but it's a really nice little visitor center and these really nice Adirondack chairs just kind of all lined up, looking out at this beautiful view in this very expensive place, and it's just a very pleasant place. And so this is the pace thing. Cindy and I sat down. Well, let's just sit and watch. And by the way, what we did for fun there, especially after Cindy had the thrilling adventure of falling off her bike, we spent a whole afternoon just watching whales or seals sleep on the rocks. I mean, it was kind of a pretty chill time. We weren't real active, kind of sitting around watching things. But one thing I noticed, we sat there and the sun was shining and it was this beautiful view and we're just holding hands and sitting there looking and just enjoying it. And I kind of dozed off for a little while. I'll bet there were 20 people who came, sat down, had someone take a picture, and got up and left. You know why these chairs are here? This is not a photo op. This is a place to sit and rest and just be for a minute. And I think my mouth fell open. I made a drool a little bit. Just sleeping in this chair because that's what I think they were for. And all these Asian tourists come, oh, take a picture. Just sit down. Just relax. Just enjoy this. Just be somewhere for a little while. It is anathema to our culture. So the whole idea of waiting for something that seems really important or that we really long for just does not fit with anything about us in our culture. We're just not conditioned for it. So it's an important concept if it is, in fact, a major theme of what it means to be in hope. Okay? Victoriously waiting. And I wanted to put it as an active. It's a process. You aren't victorious in waiting. You are either failing at waiting or you are living victoriously. Because it will never end. It is an ongoing thing. We have to cultivate habits and patterns that allow us to be in this process of victoriously waiting, because from now until the time you see Jesus, you're going to be waiting for things. Hope, at its very definition core, is expressed in waiting. It's expressed in waiting. I want to read this passage. I'm going to read all three. There's a few key verses that it seems to be a season in David's life where he's wrestling with the evil being done to him and re-shepherding his heart and his soul and his mind back to this place, refreshing himself. It's instructive. It's not something you just land. It is an active practice of refreshing ourselves in this idea of, as God is the source of his hope, his refuge. And there's verses and ideas and promises that are rooted in this section. And I've kind of cut them all out. So if you follow, I've cut a few of the contrasts and some of the warnings out of this and just kind of highlighted through these three chapters some of the highlights of what it means to be thinking rightly about waiting. Does that make sense? So just be looking for those, listening for those. Read along up here. Hear my cry, O God. Listen to my prayer. From the end of the earth, I call to you when my heart is faint. Lead me to the rock that is higher than I. For you have been my refuge, a strong tower against the enemy. Let me dwell in your tent forever. Let me take refuge under the shelter of your wings. For you, O God, have heard my vows. You have given me the heritage of those who fear your name. Prolong the life of the king. May his years endure to all generations. So I will ever sing praises to your name as I perform my vows day after day. For God alone, my soul waits in silence. From him comes my salvation. He alone is my rock and my salvation, my fortress. I shall not be greatly shaken. For God alone, O my soul, wait in silence, for my hope is from him. He only is my rock and my salvation, my fortress. I shall not be shaken. On God rests my salvation and my glory, my mighty rock, my refuge is God. Trust in him at all times. O people, pour out your heart before him. God is a refuge for us. Put no trust in extortion. Set no vain hopes on robbery. If riches increase, set not your heart on them. Once God has spoken, twice I have heard this, that power belongs to God. And that to you, O Lord, belongs steadfast love, for you will render to man according to his work. O God, you're my God. Earnestly I seek you. My soul thirsts for you. My flesh faints for you, as in dry and weary land where there is no water. So I have looked upon in you in the sanctuary, beholding your power and glory, because your steadfast love is better than life. My lips will praise you. So I will bless you as long as I live. In your name I will lift up my hands. My soul will be satisfied as with fat and rich food, and my mouth will praise you with joyful lips when I remember you upon my bed and meditate on you in the watches of the night. For you have been my help. In the shadow of your wings I will sing for joy. My soul clings to you. Your right hand upholds me. There's a lot there. A lot of reminders, a lot of calls to look at God in a certain light, in a certain way, with a certain expectation, with a certain confidence. All of those things are contrary to your flesh and to our culture and to what it feels like on the inside when you long for something. Now, the great danger in hope, it's when we hope for good in the land of the living, it sets us up because we are not inclined to think about these spiritual things. We're not inclined to think about the relational things, the connecting things, the internal things, the condition of our heart, our ability to love and be loved, to rest, to have peace. We're not inclined to hope for the fruit of the Spirit. We're inclined to hope for things, circumstances, money. And if you read the whole passage, and you put the verses back in that I took out, took a little poetic license with David's work here, you'll see what he contrasts it with. And some of those are putting your hope in money, putting your hope in you know, enemies being smited and all those kind of things. He goes, nope, that's not my hope. It's not what I'm waiting for. I'm waiting for something better than all those things. So this idea of waiting implies hope. You could wait, I suppose, in hopelessness, just waiting around. And that's why I think some people end up just cashing in. They're waiting for something, but they have no hope. There's nothing out there. It's one of the core elements of being clinically depressed is you have no hope. It's not going to get better. It becomes impossible in your psyche, in your mind, in your faith to think it's ever going to get better. And that leads you to depression. so victoriously waiting? Why is hope such a big deal to God? What is he doing? Why does he make us wait? What is the deal? What is the outcome that he's looking for that requires us to wait? I mean, unless he's just randomly forgetting what he was doing and absentmindedly running around the universe going, hold that thought, I gotta run over here, just hold on. Unless he's just lost it, there's a purpose in all of it. There's something he's trying to accomplish. Something of great value to him. And it's of greater worth to goal for him. Why is hope such a big deal? Because it's an integral part of faith. In the definition, Hebrews 11:1. Now faith is the assurance of things hoped for. Faith, by definition, is when we attach ourselves to something that we're confident because of God's promise. When we lack confidence because God never promised it, it doesn't lead to faith, nor does it lead to hope. It leads to anxiety. If I'm not sure, it doesn't lead me to faith. It leads me to being confused and conflicted and anxious. The assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen, because the real faith, biblical faith, is placing it in those things that God has actually promised us. Anything we choose to hope for, to put faith in, that he has not promised, can lead to all kinds of negative consequences in our hearts and our minds and in our larger faith, the way of faith. Hebrews 11:6, and without faith it is impossible to please him. Well, why is faith a big deal? Because that's what trips his trigger. That's what smells good to him. That's how we respond to him. That's how we declare our love for him, our confidence in him, when we believe him and we make choices that reflect that belief. God goes, there it is. That's what I want. That's what I love. And when we're young in our faith, he even grants things that are circumstantial just to grow our faith. But he wants to keep us taking us to this place that I believe he took David, where the circumstances were not the hope. And the good in the land of the living was no longer circumstantial or financial, but it was deeply spiritual and it was deeply relational. It was an eternal good that we experience now. And it's hard for us to flip that switch. Good in the land of the living, that means... And we build our list of stuff and things. And that's not God's agenda. Because what he wants to do is cultivate this economy of faith. And make you rich in this economy by growing your faith. That requires waiting. And we don't like it. So I just have three things that I believe we can find in this passage, but are mega biblical themes in my understanding, but they're certainly found in those three psalms. Keys, the key elements of victorious waiting. These are habits. These are not one and done. These are things we make choices to do day by day, moment by moment, in order to stay in faith, to stay in a posture of waiting in victory. See, you can wait and wring your hands. You can wait and be really, really anxious. Or you can wait with confidence and assurance. Maybe not today, but someday. Maybe not today. Maybe not tomorrow. Maybe not this year. But someday, the promise of God, I'm going to experience it. And I am going to experience the good of God in the land of the living. So our praise is rooted in a couple things, but he builds this foundation of experience of him in history and in our lives that we can look back and go, well, this looks and feels true, but we can turn back and go, but that's who God is. That's what God has done. That's the foundation of praise. Without that foundation, you will never praise. You will just wring your hands. We have to look back. We have to look back. For what we do know about God and his actions and his plan. And that gives us power to look forward
victoriously waiting that God is going to resolve all of this. And I so appreciate every thought John had, but in church history, there's lots of people that circumstantially, there's lots of people today who do not experience any form of good that you would define in a circumstantial way. They have lives of suffering. They have lives of brokenness. They have lives of poverty. So if there is a good that they experience, it is not the lists we build. It is something spiritual, something eternal, something connected, something relational. And that can transcend anywhere. Bonhoeffer in prison in Germany, he experienced the good of God in the land of the living. But it was not circumstantial. That's our great danger. That's our great temptation, because everything around us all the time, our flesh longs for the things that say, I want that, and I want that, and I want that, and I want that. We had kind of crazy. We had made a visit to a $10 million house, sitting in the kitchen, walking around the pool. $10 million, that's a lot of house. California, it's not as much house as you might think. But their neighbors had a $68 million house. So much wealth. The entire city of Carmel, you can't buy a house, and they are shacks. Think downtown east of the, I own one of those, 800 square foot little cottage built for workers on the railroad or the beet plant. That's what they were built for. Utilitarian housing. Probably cost $3,000 to build. You can't buy one of those in Carmel, California for less than $2 million. And you can't see the ocean. That's what we're prone to think about. God says, I have something better. I have something better. So this praise, victoriously waiting, requires a discipline of praise. It's not waiting around till we feel like praising. It is shepherding our heart. Do you understand? That's what David is doing in these Psalms. He didn't wake up and go, wow, this is an awesome day. I'm going to praise the Lord. He was being chased around. His enemies were all around him. He was being betrayed. He was being misunderstood. He was living in the desert. This is the king. He shepherded his heart back to a place of praise in spite of circumstances. I've said it many times. I will say it until God writes in the heavens, shut up about this, you're wrong. I believe this is the peace. Scripturally, that is the critical piece to how we experience life. If we will not cultivate gratitude for what God has done, who He is, what He's done in our life, and you have plenty of source material right there, no circumstance in your life will ever counter who God is, what He has done, and what He has already done in your life. There's no set of bad circumstances, no set of suffering that could ever even compare to the good you've received from God. But it is a discipline. It is a practice. It is a habit. So all of us sing praises to your name. Do you see that verse? As I perform my vows, day after day, there are rhythms that were established in the priesthood, in the early church. There are rhythms of saying, I'm going to do this every day. Under the old covenant, there were things that God did day by day, week by week, month by month, year by year. These vows, these practices of reorienting to something that is core and foundational to our experience of God. Praise is one of those. We have to do it. We have to do it so that we can access the victory and the joy and the power and the peace that flows from that connection. It's a right orientation. That too is relational. It's not a box to check. It's a drawing near and seeing God for who He is and receiving from God all that He's promised internally and celebrating that in our hearts. We have an incredible capacity as human beings to look at a set of circumstances and go, this is awful. Or this is amazing. It's the same circumstance. when we see God's lens, when we look for His, we watched, there was a seal struggling in the surf, but we thought he was playing. We got out, went a little closer to him, and I don't know if he broke his back or he was struggling. Probably we watched the last few minutes or hours of his life. He hadn't, but just, there was a God moment. There was a glorious God moment of seeing this creation and how precious life is even to a dumb seal. I don't know how intelligent seals are. Maybe they're not dumb. You go, God, you've made something precious in life. And that animal, we're sad, ready to cry. We don't want to watch a seal die. What is it of your spirit in that seal that makes it fight for life? There's something precious that your thumbprint is in creation, in the heart of a beast. It says, I must fight for life. And we've been granted it. We're grateful. We have eternal life. That which satisfies the creation we've been granted. Second piece of this, because your steadfast love is better than life. There's just a little thing I just wrote here. I don't even know if it's accurate. It seems like it. It's true for me. If I'm going to be steadfast in my praise, it requires a regular recognition of His steadfast love. Because your steadfast love is better than life, my lips will praise you. If I don't recognize God's steadfast love, if I interpret my circumstances or the circumstances of the world and say God is not steadfast in His love, it's going to be really challenging for me to have steadfast praise, to practice that vow day by day. That's the first key, praise. Second key, understand that God knows good. You got many in the room, maybe too young or not interested in sports advertising, but years ago, Bo Jackson, I think he's about my age. He also has a couple hips replaced, so we have a lot in common. there was an advertising campaign, I think it was Bo Knows Football or Bo Knows Sports or something, or some Nike commercial. We think we know good better than God. And then we judge God based on that assumption. God's not good. God doesn't know good. If God was good, if God knew good, my circumstances, my life, whatever it is, would be different. A practice of waiting victoriously is knowing that God knows good. And sometimes what you want is not good. And it won't be your best good. John did a great job last week talking about ultimate good. But today, as you experience life, will you look for and receive what God brings into it and receive it as good and define it as good? Or will we judge it? Will we judge it and say, nope, that can't be good because that makes me feel, pick an emotion. Pick a negative emotion. God says, I want that to press you in. Psalm 62, verse 1. For God alone my soul waits in silence. From Him comes my salvation. He alone is my rock and my salvation, my fortress. I shall not be greatly shaken. On God rests my salvation, my glory, my mighty rock, my refuge is God. Trust in Him at all times, O people. Pour out your hearts before Him. God is a refuge for us. One of the pieces that I drew out of that passage, Psalm 62, 1 through 2 or 3, I believe, God is a person. God is not a wish list. God is not a vending machine. God connects when we come close. I believe it is an offense to God. Now, He's really patient with us, but I think it breaks His heart. When He offers us Himself, He declares Himself Emmanuel. And we say, God, give me good. Here I am. No, 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 I want the other good. I want the other good. I want the circumstantial good. I want the rich good, the car good, the girl good, whatever it is. The good, you know, the good. Yeah, you're good. And we never actually cultivate, well, wait a minute. There's this opportunity by the power of the Spirit to actually experience the presence of God on a regular basis as comforter, as joy giver, as friend, as lover of our souls, as delighted in husband, or delighted, he delights in us as husband, our husband. And he looks at us and he shouts over us with joy. He says, I want to bring you good. Here I am. And all these other circumstances, they're all just designed to move you to this place, to move you to this opportunity where we can experience greater and greater good. Will you wait? Will you wait like the bridegroom? Will you believe these words? I can't wait to come back and get you. The Father set a time, and I'm longing for that, to come back and scoop you all up and give you good. And in the meantime, the good is resting in those promises. The good is knowing He is with you. Either that or a whole bunch of people get ripped off. The promise isn't true for lots of people who struggle and suffer. There is progress, and that's great. But the ultimate good is Him and His promises. Last element is to recognize that God is bringing you good. As we let Him define what good is, as we recognize His primary goal is training our faith, bringing out of us this response to a person and living in light of that, we have to stay in step with the training of God. We have to stay in step with the training of God. James 1, verse 2 through 4. Nobody likes this passage. It's really true. When it comes to waiting in victory, count it all joy, my brothers, when you meet trials of various kinds, for you know that the testing of your faith produces steadfastness. Remember that word from Psalm 63? Steadfastness. It's a high value for God. Believing and hoping over time does something. It drives something into us. For you know that the testing of your faith produces steadfastness, and let steadfastness have its full effect, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. That's the outcome. Okay? That's what God's going for. The image of Jesus Christ being lived out in your life and faith as an image bearer. As one who can be filled and controlled and bear the fruit of the Holy Spirit's presence in your life. That you may be perfect and complete. But you can't be perfect and complete without steadfastness. Okay? So it's not an end in itself. Gee, I'm steadfast. That's not why God makes us wait. It's because in that waiting, He leads us on this journey of perfection and completeness. Do we understand all that? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. I've got to show you this video, and I don't know if I can make it work. It's from a tweet. It's not on YouTube. And I don't know if I can make it work, but we're going to try. There is a point to it. How do I do this? I'm going to change my setting here. Sorry, I got in about 11 o'clock last night, and I didn't have my computer on the trip by design. Duplicate. What's up there? Yep, okay. Thank you for your patience. All right, can you see that? All right, let me make it full screen. I don't think it still goes full screen, but it's better. Are you ready?
Okay. Funny video. Did you catch the heading? Read the heading. That's what's brilliant about this video. I'm not sure what you're doing, but I love you. I just want to be involved. That's the story of following God and waiting. Hi, I'm not sure what you're doing, but I want to be where you are. So today, if we're doing thrust, whatever those are, I am in. I am in. God is bringing you good. Is that up there now? Yeah, you're going to have to look at that screen for just a little bit. There's a process of staying in step, obedience, faithfulness, letting God develop that steadfastness as we walk through and understand. Do you ever feel like that with God? I know He's doing something. I don't know what it is. Here's our temptation. When we're unclear about what God is doing, we tend to just step away. We step away from obedience. We step away from the activity that He's called us to and command us. Say, keep doing these things. Keep practicing those vows. Keep being a witness. Keep stepping into this yoke. I know you don't get it. I know you don't understand it. Quite frankly, we are so arrogant to think you understand almost anything about God. His ways are so different. It's like God is reading a newspaper and we're a dog sitting there watching Him going, oh yeah, He's totally reading a newspaper. Like, we would know what that means. There's this huge chasm between the story and the way and the process that God uses to define and develop this incredibly valuable thing for you called faith. That a key piece of it is learning to wait and to be steadfast. And we just judge Him and go, I don't know what you're doing. I don't know, but I'm just going to sit here and do nothing until you prove yourself once again. I'm just going to sit and watch. I'm going to shrink back because there's no... Step in. Step into the room. Step in with me. I will walk with you through this. Keep staying in step. It will all become clear. The fruit will all become clear. And that's the essence of faith. It is the assurance of something hoped for. That clarity, that peace, that connection is part of the prize. Your faith will... There's coming a day when whatever faith you have, that is your faith. And whatever you did but according to faith, it will be over for good and evil. But God doesn't want you to miss one little piece of that. Let's hang on to that. If you guys want to come on up, Danny. I'm closing down here. I have a closing song. So, victorious waiting involves at least these three things. It's this discipline of praise to practice your vows daily. Letting God define what is good. Staying involved when you have no idea what you are doing or what God is doing. Then we don't have to wring our hands. Then we can be waiting in connection. We can be waiting with God as refuge. And it can lead us to joy. Let me pray. Father, I just thank You so much that You've called us to victory. You've called us to be a people who know You and walk with You and enjoy You and trust You and praise You. You certainly enjoy it when it's by faith, but it's good for our souls. It redefines our experience and our interpretation of our circumstances. And we want to be people. We're going to be waiting. That much is a given. God, let us wait victoriously. In Jesus' name, amen.